I proposed last week in part one of this sermon that when it comes to how men and women are to relate to one another in the book of Ruth, we find in the story an illustration, not a principle. The principle, though, is found in the teaching of the Apostle Paul in such places as Ephesians 5 and 1 Corinthians 7, 1 Corinthians 11. The principle can be stated this way. It is that from the beginning, God intended men and women to live in a glory-filled interdependence, full of diversity and yet harmony. Why? In order to reflect on earth the relationship between God the Father and God the Son in heaven. If we had to compress it as much as possible from 1 Corinthians 11, it would go like this. And last week we said that in 1 Corinthians 11 there are two things. There is a practical, culture-bound application in that text, and there is timeless theological principle that the Apostle Paul lays as a foundation for the practical application. And we discussed that fairly obscure practical application last week, and we're not going to go into it again. But if we compressed 1 Corinthians 11, we would put it this way. I'm just going to quote from Paul. Now, I want you to realize that the head of every man, possibly we are to translate husband there, is Christ. And the head of the woman, or the wife, is man, and the head of Christ is God. A man is the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of man. For man did not come from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. And so what's Paul's conclusion? It's in verse 11 of 1 Corinthians 11. So woman is not independent of man. Now, this seems to have been part of the practical problem in the First Baptist Church of Corinth that the Apostle Paul is writing to. If I called it the First Presbyterian Church, you would think me arrogant, so I call it the First Baptist Church there in Corinth. But some of the Christian wives seem to have been insisting that now that they were Christians and the kingdom of God had broken in on the world, they were totally emancipated from living in submission to their husbands. No, the Apostle Paul says, woman or the wife is not independent of man. And you can just imagine all the men in the church clapping and cheering. Yeah, that's right, Paul. Woman is not independent of man. Verse 11, however, nor is man independent of woman in the Lord, Paul adds. That is, in Christ. In the perspective of the kingdom of God and its order, its economy, how it is structured. For, Paul says, as woman came from man, so also man is born of woman, and or but everything comes from God. The men are not to lord it over the women. Indeed, the women are to be submissive to their husbands. But the men are not to lord it over the women. Not only are they radically equal in being, because the woman is made by God just as he is. She was made to be a fit for him, a complement to him, even more. Every man, the Apostle Paul argues, every man after Adam owes his very life to a woman. His mother. What is Eve called in Genesis 3? She is called the mother of all the living. But what was to be a glorious interdependence turned quickly after the fall into sin in Eden. It turned quickly to a deep alienation, mistrust, to hostility and manipulation between men and women. And there developed What C.S. Lewis once called, as we noted last week, a sword between the sexes. I was talking about this whole theme with someone the other day, and she told me that an Indian friend of hers had said something like this: well, that's fine if the husband is the head, as long as the woman can be the neck, because the neck turns the head this way and that. One of the church fathers once said about women, what is the difference whether it is in a wife or a mother? It is still Eve the temptress that we must beware of in any woman. Now, listen carefully. Actually, I'm not sure I have a problem with that theologically, as long as the women are allowed to say to one another this: what is the difference whether it is in a husband or a father? It is still Adam, the passive blame shifter, that we must be aware of in any man. There is a sense in which Adam is a type of all men, and Eve is a type of all women. That's an attitude that comes from the sword that is between the sexes. But when we turn to the book of Ruth, what do we see? Well, we see first, and it's implied, Lewis's sword between the sexes. Turn to Ruth chapter 2, page 413, Ruth chapter 2. We've already remarked on this several times. In verse 9 of chapter 2, Ruth the Moabite widow has come to glean, to pick up a little grain on the edges of the field in Boaz's fields. And what does Boaz say to her? Verse 9, watch the field where the men are harvesting and follow along after the girls. I have told the men not to touch you. Boaz has to give particular instruction to his men that they don't misuse her in any way. And if you go to verse 22 of Ruth chapter 2, what does Naomi say? Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it will be good for you, my daughter, to go with Boaz's girls, because in someone else's field you might be harmed. In the ESV it says you might be assaulted. Now, you see, it is the case that men do not merely have from Adam a natural sinful instinct toward passivity and blame shifting. There is something else. Remember what God said to Eve after her disobedience and Adam's, by way of judgment and punishment. All relationships are going to have an inclination now to be twisted. What does the Lord say to Eve? Your desire shall be for your husband, and we might say paradoxically, but he shall rule over you. Now, here's one place where I disagree respectfully with Francis Schaeffer. This is not God introducing the authority of the man implicit in his headship. This is not God introducing the authority structure after the fall, because after all, now with sin in the world, pure democracy is utopian, so someone has to have final authority. No, the headship of the man over the woman was there from the beginning. It was built into the structure of creation. It was there, of course, in order that women might flourish. What happens, though, now that sin has driven a sword between the man and the woman? He will rule over you. Rule in the sense of dominate. His natural tendency will be to misuse his headship, to be domineering and harsh, angry, overbearing, dictatorial, demanding, all too often even brutal. That's why in the instructions in the New Testament, Paul can say to the men in Colossae, do not be harsh with your wives. Time and again, sadly, we see that natural, twisted inclination of men lived out in stories in the Bible and in St. Louis. There is the dark side, the sword between the sexes, intimated in the Book of Ruth. But the central theme when it comes to men and women in the Book of Ruth is not what Schaeffer once called the minor theme of the Bible, that is the brokenness of the world, the broken and fallen relationship, but rather what is so central in the Book of Ruth is the redeemed relationship between men and women, as exemplified supremely in how Boaz treats Ruth, how Ruth treats him, how Boaz treats Naomi, how Naomi treats him. But it is also revealed in how these two groups of men and women in the story relate to Naomi, Boaz, Ruth, and Obed, the four main characters in the story. The two groups are the 10 elders at the session meeting in the town gate when they sit as judges. And then it is the welcoming committee, older women who were Naomi's friends, many of whom we learn from the story remembered her from more than 10 years ago when she was there. In the Lord, the woman is not independent of man, nor is the man independent of woman. And all things come from God. Let's just summarize in terms of Boaz's attitude to Ruth, and you can follow along if you have your Bible because it will take too much time to read all of these, but in verse 5 of chapter 2, we find Boaz being genuinely interested in Ruth. He sees her gleaning in his field, and the first thing he says to his foreman is, "Who is this?" He's genuinely interested. Secondly, he is concerned to help her get food and water. In chapter 2, verses 8 and 9, it becomes clear that Boaz tries to make provision there for Ruth, that she might get some lunch, that she might have some water. Already in the passage we quoted in verse 9 of chapter 2, Boaz is strict with his men about not harassing Ruth in any way because he's trying to be kind and honorable to her. If we look at verses 11 and 12 in chapter 2, we see that Boaz expresses to Ruth his genuine appreciation of her. Boaz replied to Ruth, verse 11 of chapter 2, "I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother in your homeland and came to live with the people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done." That's a compliment. "May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." He has a genuine spiritual concern for Ruth that is expressed to her in this blessing of God that he invokes over her. He extends warm hospitality to her by inviting her. She's a foreigner. It would appear as if Ruth was expected by the social rules of the day to go and sit off someplace alone because she is a foreigner, or maybe because she's new. But Boaz says, "No, come and sit here with the others." You find that in verse 14 of chapter 2. And then in verses 15 and 16, what does Boaz do? He arranges a success for her in terms of her gleaning. He tells his men, "Hey, don't get too persnickety here. Don't watch her too closely. If she goes a little bit where she's not supposed to go, that's fine. Don't worry about it. In fact, pull a few grains out of the piles there, the sheaves, and just put them down for her." He's arranging a success for her. He's an accurate judge of her character because he has wisdom and integrity. Men of wisdom and integrity understand and can see women of integrity and character. In verse 11, he says, of chapter 3, "All the people in town know that you are a worthy woman, an honorable woman." Boaz We note also does not take any sexual advantage of Ruth out in the field. They're all alone. He acts most honorably in that situation. And then, of course, supremely, he meets his social responsibility to marry Ruth. In verse 11 of chapter 3, Boaz says very clearly to Ruth, "You have nothing to be afraid of. I will do what you ask." In verse 10, look at verse 10 of chapter 3. What does Boaz say to Ruth? "The Lord bless you, my daughter. This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor." She has settled for him. He's an old guy, probably 60 or more. Boaz seems genuinely moved and grateful that Ruth should choose him when she could have, he implies very clearly, chosen a younger man. And we could go on. Nor is man independent of woman. And that is to affect how men treat women. Men are to respect women. They are to honor them. They are to protect and provide and care for them. That is part of the man's glory. Men, husbands in particular, how are you doing in that department? Those of you who are here, and those of you who say things to your wives and treat them, of course, most of that remains out of public view. How are you doing? What about Ruth to Boaz? Look in verse 10 of chapter 2. She has deep and profound respect for Boaz. She is genuinely moved by his kindness to her. And so we read in verse 10, after he has said, "Make sure that you get enough water here, the men will get it for you." At this, she bowed down with her face to the ground in front of him. It was a way in the ancient world of honoring someone. She exclaimed, "Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?" She has deep respect toward Boaz. Some of you know the book Love and Respect. A couple of you I know right now in the congregation, a couple of men, are reading that book. It's a book that emphasizes. Sometimes he may be errs on the side of saying this is the key to everything, but he stresses that women are called to respect their husbands, that men, husbands, are called to love with tenderness their wives. Well, also, Ruth is profoundly humble toward Boaz. She follows through with Naomi's bold plan, even though she knew Boaz might reject her. And yet in her humility, she goes through with it. What about Boaz to Naomi? Look at verse 11 in chapter 2. Boaz was no couch potato. He's taken in. He's heard. He's noted. He's paid attention to the fact, "I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother." He's saying that to Ruth, but why does he appreciate that? Because he cares about Naomi. It is a relative of his. He knows Naomi's desperate situation, and he cares. Well, also, if you look at verse 17 of chapter 3, now, of course, this is his future mother-in-law. But in verse 17 of chapter 3, we see that Boaz gives to Ruth 6 measures of barley, saying, "Don't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed." He sends home extra food with Ruth for Naomi's sake. And then, of course, Naomi is incredibly blessed by his decision to marry Ruth. What about Naomi to Boaz? Look at verse 20 of chapter 2. When Naomi hears not only that Ruth has landed in Boaz's field, but when she hears how kind Boaz has been, what does she say? The first thing that comes out of her mouth is a blessing. "The Lord bless him." And of course, then she takes initiative. with Boaz. She acts with boldness toward him. Her wheels are turning when she realizes who it is. Look at verse 20 of chapter 2. She says, "That man is our close relative. He is one of our kinsmen redeemers." Yes, she's thinking. And her wheels begin to turn. It's a very puzzling question, isn't it, as to why Boaz is not the one who takes initiative in the whole situation regarding Ruth. The storyteller leaves us tantalizingly in the dark about that. But what if, there's some explanation for it, what if Naomi knew, perhaps through the other women, that Boaz was extremely sensitive to the large age gap between him and Ruth? We know that from the story. He's significantly older. What if he was sensitive to that and didn't want to put Ruth on the spot of having to turn down an old geezer who wanted her hand in marriage? What if that was the reason that Boaz hung back? What if Naomi knew that? And that's the reason that she took initiative. The headship of the husband over the wife does not mean that in every situation it is only the man who is to take initiative. And the women are to be only silent and passive responders. In some large general sense, it may be true that the man is the initiator, that the man has a responsibility before God to initiate always an assessment of what is going on in the home, of what is going on in the marriage. But there are plenty of stories in the Bible where women take initiative. And there is no hint that they are wrong for doing that. Well, let's go now to the 10 elders. Look at how they treat Ruth in chapter 4. In verse 2, Boaz has called them together. It's essentially a session meeting. They're sitting as judges, which was their responsibility as elected or appointed men in Israel. It is a church state. And so this is their responsibility. But what do? Here they are, staunch defenders of what we might call Israelite exceptionalism, that Israel is chosen by God, and she is superior to all the other nations. What do? They welcome Ruth, even though she is a foreigner, even though she is from a place that most people in Israel despised, Moab. What do? In verse 11 of chapter 4, they pronounce a blessing on her. "Then the elders and all those at the gate said, 'We are witnesses. It's a done deal now. The other kinsman redeemer has disqualified himself.' But then what do they say? 'May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel.'" What about the second group that we find here? These are men. We have a group of Naomi's female friends. They meet Naomi when she returns in chapter 1 of verse 19, and they say, "This is amazing. Can this really be Naomi? She left here over a decade ago." How does chapter 1 end? It ends with Naomi's bitter lament over all her losses, her emptiness. How does chapter 4 end? Chapter 4 ends with Naomi's female friends praising God for the way he has filled Naomi's life with something good, a grandson that she seems to have parented. If you go to chapter 4 and you look at these verses beginning at 14, "The women said to Naomi, 'Praise be to the Lord who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer.'" Now the kinsman redeemer is no longer Boaz, it is Obed, Ruth's and Boaz's son. "May he become famous throughout Israel." It is literally, "May his name be renowned. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth." Then Naomi took the child and laid him in her lap and cared for him. There's actually a noun here, It's literally, and became his nurse, or became a foster mother. The sense seems to be that in some substantial way, Ruth and Boaz handed over Obed to Naomi for her to parent him, at least to a substantial degree. The women living there said, Naomi has a son. And they named him Obed. It's possible that this refers to his parents, but most commentators believe that the storyteller is telling us here that this group of women gave the name Obed to the son of Ruth and Boaz, a name that means one who serves or who is a worker. You see, these were women who lived in God's order, as it were. They accepted it. They did not despise that order. They did not despise the male leadership of the church state that God had set up Israel to be. They didn't despise marriage. They didn't despise men, though I love this in verse 15, for your daughter-in-law who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons has given birth to him. All women know that one good woman is worth seven mediocre men, don't they? But this is not the rant of those who believe themselves superior to men. One feminist reading of Ruth I looked at had this passage in it, quote, in so many interpretations of Ruth, the story's ultimate endorsement of the women seems to be that they serve the interests of men. Well, in part, that's true. What did Paul say? The woman is the glory of man. A wife finds at least a significant part of her vocation before the Lord in supporting her husband and the work that God has called him to do. That is why everywhere in Scripture God calls husbands, or calls wives rather, to respect their husbands. Those of you who are wives here this morning, how are you doing with that vocation that God has given to you? But what does Paul write in Ephesians 5? That also, paradoxically, the man, after the pattern of Jesus Christ, whose glory the man is to emulate, is also supposed to serve the interests of his wife. There, Paul says, husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and bossed her around. Loved the church and condescendingly corrected her. Loved the church and angrily made demands of her. No, it's Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. The book of Ruth, and all the commentators acknowledge it, is clearly told from the point of view of women, of these two destitute, bereaved widows. And it is even principally told from Naomi's point of view, she who had lost everything, who struggled to hang on to the truth that God never forsakes his children, who called herself bitter instead of what her name, Naomi, really meant, which is pleasant. Naomi, who came back to Israel utterly empty, and so she thought, opposed by God. She now, at the end of the story, sits with a lap full of blessing, plenty of food, and what's more, a grandson who apparently was to be more like a son. Here's the storyline. Naomi is, in fact, the receiver of God's blessing, and Ruth is the hero, humble, and with a loyalty that was staggeringly deep and pure. Ruth had said to her mother-in-law, Naomi, and she might as well have said, my mother, where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, And your God, my God, where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you from me. There it is. The heroic loyalty that became the instrument in God's hand to rescue Naomi. That's the storyline. It is. But the storyline is more complicated than that, isn't it? Because honorable Boaz, the man of integrity, he is a hero in the story as well. He is the kinsman redeemer who rises to fulfill his social responsibility first by caring about Naomi and Ruth, and then by marrying Ruth. So what's the point? It is both Ruth and Boaz who are heroes in the story. They are both instruments in the hand of God, and that is exactly what we would expect if, in fact, woman is not independent of the man and the man is not independent of the woman. It is a glorious thing that this story is told from the point of view of the women. I will even acknowledge that in a certain sense, the women in the story do serve the interests of the men. But that is part of their glory as women. But now here also is the paradox. And this is most important in serving the interests of men, in focusing on marriage and the securing of a male heir and the maintenance of the family property. These women most certainly understood that they were also serving their own interests, because before these women were women, they were persons. That's the great affirmation in Dorothy Sayers' little essay I mentioned last week, Are Women Human?, the sarcastic title of her book. Before these women, they were persons. And the most significant thing about them as persons was that they were Israelites. People God had called to himself and done what with? Promised them everything. And he had committed himself to them and their offspring. How? By binding himself in a blood-marked covenant. One commentator writes this: in all probability, Obed originally meant servant of Naomi. He became her kinsman redeemer by assuring her family's survival and providing her food. Naomi's needs had been marvelously met. The narrator was not finished, however. Just as the reader savored Naomi's sweet success, the narrator suddenly steps forward with a surprise, a kind of final exclamation point, and it's in verse 17. He, that is Obed, was the father of Jesse. And then the writer adds, the father of David. This commentator goes on, this short genealogy comments that Naomi's son Obed turned out to be the grandfather of Israel's revered King David. Suddenly, the simple, clever, human story of two struggling widows takes on a startlingly new dimension. It becomes a bright, radiant thread woven into the fabric of Israel's larger national history. These women are not simply in the kitchen making cookies. They are contributing to the national history of Israel. Obed's name, perhaps, added the nuance servant of Yahweh, of God. For in the end, his service to Naomi served Yahweh's larger purpose as well. The well-wishers at the gate, that is the men, and at Naomi's house, that is the group of women, they turned out to be prophets. Ruth, Boaz, and Obed had become famous ancestors of a ruling dynasty. For Ruth, of course, this was the crowning event of her strange but exciting saga. Who would have forecast such a destiny for a Moabite immigrant? With what generosity Yahweh rewards those who seek refuge under his wings. And later he says Ruth had become the founding mother of David's dynasty. More importantly, Yahweh's guidance takes on new meaning. His gracious care for two defenseless widows now emerges as divine guidance for the benefit of all Israel. The reader now perceives it as the dimly visible thread which wove together the dangerous disarray of the period of the judges, when everybody did what was right in their own eyes, with the glorious empire of David. Thus the book redeems Elimelech's tragic fate, Naomi's husband, with a reaffirmation of God's sovereignty. The words, "Father of David," in verse 17 of chapter 4, removed the bitter irony which the name Elimelech had created. What does his name mean? "My God is king." But Elimelech died. God still did reign. This verse, that is verse 17 in chapter 4, is of course a clue to the book's purpose, to show that the reign of David resulted from neither his shrewd politics nor his clever tactics, but from the divine preservation of his worthy family line. The narrator finally wove together all remaining thematic threads into a delightful finished cloth. In two scenes, one in the courtroom with the men, the 10 elders, the city gate, the other in the living room with Naomi's friends. In those two scenes, the storyteller finally wove together the story's earlier pain, agony, and uncertainty, as that all now gives way to joy, triumph, and certainty. In the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor is man independent of woman. All things are from God. I didn't, in these two sermons, give you much by way of practical advice. Here's how to live out the headship. Here's how to live out the submission. I would commend to you that book by Egerich, Love and Respect. I would commend to you a book by Gary Thomas, Sacred Marriage. I would commend to you a book by Walt Wangerin, As for Me and My House, if you want to explore more fully some of the practical implications of these things. But friends, this is God's order. It is his structure for the relationship between the sexes. And for those who have ears to hear, it is a glorious thing. As men and women on earth reflect the majesty of God and the economy within the Trinity itself, the head of Christ is God. C.S. Lewis, before he came to Christ, described moving into a worldview, quote, where there was nothing to be obeyed and nothing to be believed except what was either comforting or exciting. That's the great challenge for people in the modern age, to come to grips with the claims of Christianity, because it calls us into obedience in areas that are not necessarily comforting or exciting. This structure, indeed, may be imposing, especially to women who have suffered much at the hands of men. It's imposing to men who have a profound inclination toward passivity, but it is the order, the economy of God, wonderfully set out for us in the principles, the great theological affirmations of the Apostle Paul, and wonderfully, I think, illustrated in the story of Ruth, Boaz, Obed, especially Naomi.